Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Welcome to Cineversary, a podcast that celebrates a milestone anniversary of a masterful work of cinema. Each month we send happy birthday wishes to a different film currently observing a joyous jubilee. That means anything from a 20th to a 100th anniversary. This is your faithful host, Eric Martin, creator of the Cineverse blog and moderator of the weekly Cineverse Film Discussion Group. And if you've just discovered our program, welcome. If you're a regular listener, we are thrilled to have you back. He is afraid. He is alone. He is 3 million light years from home. That's the tagline you probably remember from the poster back in 1982, the year that Steven Spielberg released arguably his finest film up to that point, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, which marks a 40th birthday this month. In celebration of this event, I have recruited two outstanding guests for this installment. So first up is James Kendrick, a professor of film at Baylor University who teaches courses on Spielberg, serves as the movie critic for QNetwork.com, and is the author of several books, including Darkness in the Bliss Out, a reconsideration of the films of Steven Spielberg, and Hollywood Bloodshed, Violence in 1980s American Cinema. You may recall that I interviewed James Kendrick last year at this time to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Raiders of the Lost Ark, so it's a real treat to have him back on the show. I'm also going to be joined by Cassine Gaines, a director, educator, pop culture historian, and author of several books, including the forthcoming E.T. the Extraterrestrial, The Ultimate Visual History. My guests and I will examine how E.T. set a new template for sci-fi adventure films, why and how it has stood the test of time, reasons it's worth celebrating four decades on, its cultural impact and legacy, and more. First, however, what do you say we take a moment and get contexted up, if you will, on the who, what, when, where, and why behind E.T.'s creation, courtesy of our friends at Wikipedia. E.T. the Extraterrestrial is a 1982 American science fiction film produced and directed by Steven Spielberg and written by Melissa Matheson. It tells the story of Elliot, a boy who befriends an extraterrestrial he calls E.T., who is left behind on Earth by his fellow creatures. Along with his friends and family, Elliot must find a way to help E.T. return home and evade government forces intent on capturing, keeping, and studying E.T. The film stars Dee Wallace, Henry Thomas, Peter Coyote, Robert McNaughton, and Drew Barrymore. The movie's concept was based on an imaginary friend that Spielberg created after his parents' divorce. In 1980, Spielberg met Matheson and developed a new story from the unrealized project he called Night Skies. In less than 2 months, Matheson wrote the first draft of the script, titled E.T. and Me, which went through 2 rewrites. The project was ultimately rejected by Columbia Pictures, which doubted its commercial potential. Fortunately, Universal Pictures eventually purchased the script for $1 million. Filming took place from September to December 1981 on a budget of approximately $10.5 million. Unlike most films, E.T. was shot in rough chronological order to facilitate convincing emotional performances from the young cast. The animatronics for the film were designed by Carlo Rambaldi. E.T. premiered as the closing film of the Cannes Film Festival on May 26, 1982, and was released in the United States on June 11th of that year. The film was an immediate blockbuster, surpassing Star Wars to become the highest-grossing movie of all time, a record it held for 11 years until Spielberg's own Jurassic Park surpassed it in 1993. E.T. was widely acclaimed by critics and is regarded as one of the finest movies of all time. It received 9 nominations at the 55th Academy Awards, winning Best Original Score, Best Visual Effects, Best Sound, and Best Sound Editing. The film was re-released in 1985 and again in 2002 to celebrate its 20th anniversary. Now, an IMAX re-release is actually scheduled for this year, August 12th, to celebrate its 40th anniversary. In 1994, E.T. was added to the United States National Film Registry of the Library of Congress, which deemed it culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. E.T. ranks number 24 on the American Film Institute's 2007 list of the greatest American movies ever, and in a separate AFI list of the greatest science fiction movies of all time, E.T. placed third. On Rotten Tomatoes, the picture earns an exemplary 99% fresh rating, earning an average critical score of 9.3 out of 10. All right, let's turn back the clock and take a repeat flight over the moon as we listen next to audio from the original theatrical trailer for E.T.
In 1975, he directed Jaws. In 1978, he directed Close Encounters of the Third Kind. In 1981, he directed Raiders of the Lost Ark. And now, Steven Spielberg brings us E.T. the Extraterrestrial. We will witness the arrival, the search, the desertion, the fear, the discovery, the friendship.
I'm keeping you.
The secret. The love. The warning. The signal. The mystery. The danger. The intrusion. The wonderment. The enchantment. The hope. The connection has been made. Universal Pictures presents Steven Spielberg's E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
Nobody wants spoiled milk, or for that matter, old Reese's Pieces from a bygone Halloween that have outlived their shelf life. Likewise, nobody likes movie spoilers. So be forewarned that James and I will be discussing sensitive plot points related to E.T. So if you've never viewed this family film fantasy, well, you know the drill by now. Go watch it already and come back to this point in the podcast. Rest assured that while you're gone,
I'll be right here.
All right, all caught up. Let's introduce our first companion on this anniversary journey, James Kendrick. Let's welcome back to our show, James Kendrick, professor of film at Baylor University, movie critic for QNetwork.com, and author of several books on filmmakers and the cinema. Jim, thanks for returning to Cineversary.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it was 1 year ago when we met to discuss Raiders of the Lost Ark for its 40th anniversary. And how has the last academic year been for you?
It's been good. You know, kind of getting back to normal, having, you know, in-person classes again and getting to get back into discussion and everything. So it's been really good.
Yeah, because a year ago, I imagine you were coming off an academic year where you're doing a lot of Zoom with your students, right?
A lot of Zoom meetings, you know, not being able to see the bottom half of my students' faces, having to memorize eyebrows, you know, that kind of thing.
Sure, yeah, that's not the ideal teaching situation, of course, but you roll with the changes, as they say.
That's right.
So terrific. And you're still teaching a Spielberg course, I take it?
Yes. I teach it pretty much every other year. I teach a course on horror films in the alternate year, generally, so I alternate those. So I'll be teaching the Spielberg course again in spring of 23.
Ah, very exciting. So take us back, Jim, to when and where you first watched this movie, and tell me more about what you love about this film and why it's important to you.
Well, I mean, as we talked about when we talked about Raiders of the Lost Ark, I'm very much a child of the late 70s and early 80s. So I really grew up with these films. You know, they're kind of the films of my childhood in a way. And so it would have been the summer between second and third grade when E.T. came out. So I was just younger than Elliot would have been in the film. So, you know, it was definitely something that I could very much identify with from that perspective. And so I saw it in the theater that summer. I remember I had a friend named Brian Hodges who saw it before I did and just went on and on about it. And he had seen it 5 times already and I needed to see this movie.
You had a friend like that too, right?
Yes. Yeah. We all have those, don't we? And you know, so I finally cajoled my mom to take me to go see it. And so I, you know, I saw it in the theater with a big audience. And I just remember being very captivated by it, you know, just being kind of from the opening moments, because it's one of those movies that just sort of drops you right into the action. You know, there's not a whole lot of setup. It's like you're there, the spaceship is there, you know, and it's mysterious and you're not sure what's happening. But, you know, it just draws you right in. I remember just being drawn in and just being held for the whole time, and then wanting to see it again immediately, you know, after.
Get right back on the roller coaster ride. No question about it. Was that a rewatch several times that summer or year? Because I know it stayed in theaters an awful long time, right?
I do recall going back and seeing it a couple of times. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, you know, Spielberg held it out of video release for, I think, 6 years. I don't think it came out on video until 1988.
That's correct. And it broke all records at that point, and it was a big deal, I recall, on VHS back in those days.
Back in the videotape days. That's right.
Right.
And so, yeah, I do remember seeing it a couple of times in theaters. And then, of course, you know, and then you didn't see it for years after that. I remember wanting to see it and being frustrated, like, why is this not on video? Why is it not on cable? Why cannot see it on HBO?
Spielberg was pulling one of those Disney tactics where he surrenders it to the vault for a few years and it comes back every so often, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
exactly.
Yeah, that was a lot of what you just recalled there was my childhood a little bit too. E.T. is probably the most emotionally impactful film I've ever seen, Jim. I mean, every rewatch, it's a three-hanky affair for me, I have to confess, because the movie brings me right back to my youth. And the last 30 minutes of this picture, I mean, it just hits me right in the solar plexus. There are only two films that can consistently make me tear up and completely surrender any pretense of composure and emotional resilience every time I see them. And those two are It's a Wonderful Life and E.T. the Extraterrestrial. So I'm not ashamed to say I get a little verklempt watching this movie.
And nor should you be ashamed.
No, but even as a grown-ass adult, I am a blathering idiot watching this movie at home on Blu-ray. So I was 13, actually, when my stepdad took me to the theater to first catch E.T. It was probably late June 1982. I knew very little about it other than the trailer I had seen and some, you know, buzz building in the press. This was, of course, nearing the end of the era when audiences showed up in droves, you know, creating extremely long wait times and crowds that often stretched around the block.
Mm-hmm.
With the proliferation of multiplex theaters later in the 1980s, those ridiculously long lines we remember would subside, right? But in 1982, chances are you had to get in a long, long line and wedge into a packed theater to see E.T. And that was certainly true of my E.T. watch that summer 40 years ago. Anyway, I walked out of that cinema utterly moved, as, you know, I was kind of a lonely child of divorce and family dysfunction. I could really relate to Elliot, so this film totally spoke to me at that relatively friendless and frustrating time in my life. Shortly thereafter, I bought the paperback novelization of the film, I remember.
Yes.
I got the John Williams soundtrack cassette. I enjoyed a few repeat viewings, so E.T. became a huge part of my life as a fledgling young teenager that year. And I was just completely swept up in the magic that Spielberg and his collaborators conjured up. And I still am. I don't think it has lost any enchantment four decades on. And again, I'm unashamed to admit that it remains that powerful to me.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I just showed it to my own kids not a month ago when they were almost 10 and almost 8. So they were right around the age that I was when I first saw it. And I can tell you, they were just as captivated by it. They were just as drawn into it.
Wow.
They were immediately pulled in. They were, you know, excited, you know, the exciting parts. They were distressed when they thought E.T. was dying. They were jumping up and down and cheering when they were escaping the government agents.
Cool.
You know, they were teary at the end. I mean, it's like it's still hits all the notes it hit in 1982 with kids
today.
That's
great. Isn't it wonderful when you can introduce one of your favorite films as a child or a teenager to your offspring, to people of a new generation, maybe even your students, right? So have you shown this in your Spielberg class?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We show it. You know, I teach the course chronologically. And so we sort of trace the development of Spielberg's career as an artist and how he changed and things stay the same. And so I show it as a double feature with Poltergeist,
okay,
which, of course, you know, came out at literally the same time. I mean, they E.T. and Poltergeist were literally playing in theaters next to each other.
Correct.
In the summer of 82. Mm-hmm. And I remember, I think it was, maybe it was Vincent Canby, the film critic at the New York Times, who wrote in his review of one of them, saying that you could basically imagine these two films taking place just on different streets in the same neighborhood.
Oh, it's so true, right?
You know, that it's like E.T. could be in one part of the neighborhood and the Freelings could be battling Poltergeist in the other. But yeah, I show it to my college students, who are mostly juniors and seniors. And mm-hmm. It surprises me, a number of them have not seen it. I would say probably a good half of them have seen it, but they saw it when they were kids. Yeah. And they haven't really seen it since then. Because, you know, kind of in their minds, they sort of categorize it as like a kid's movie. And, you know, so they saw it when they were kids. They're like, okay, I'm moving on. What's the next Marvel movie?
That's the thing, isn't it? Because this is a movie where I remember even as a teenager, you know, you kind of had to keep it to yourself. You couldn't be bragging about, oh, one of my favorite movies is E.T. It's like, oh, you lame-o, you know. Nobody watches that. What do you watch, Sesame Street? I mean, again, now at this age, I don't care. I unabashedly praise this movie to high heaven, but it can have an uncoolness factor to it if you're a certain age, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Which I think is definitely unfair to the film, because as I've written about and when I think about the film, it deals in a very straightforward and honest manner with some really heavy themes.
Sure.
And some really heavy adult ideas.
Right.
And there are ones that, you know, I really like you hearing you talk about, you know, as a teenager, you know, adolescent from a divorced family, really connecting with Elliot and understanding on an emotional level. I think it really speaks to how powerful the film is, mm-hmm. that it could speak to me as an 8-year-old, my kids as 8 and 10-year-olds, you as a 13 or 14-year-old, mm-hmm. and then us as adults,
sure.
you know, well into life. It really, I mean, and to me, that's really one of the hallmarks of a truly classic, timeless film, is one that sort of hits all age groups in different ways. You know, you don't watch it the same as an 8-year-old as you do as a 40-year-old.
True.
But it's still that powerful experience.
Completely. Yeah. Now, like this most recent rewatch, I'm putting myself in the shoes of Mary, Elliot's mother, more.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's some cringeworthy moments where you're thinking, like, okay, she's leaving those kids home alone. Like, she may not be mother of the year, but I really kind of empathize with her more on more recent rewatches because I'm more in her age group. So you see, you're right. You see it through different lenses based on the time of your life.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's dig a little deeper here, Jim, and I want to explore why and how E.T. is worth celebrating 40 years later. So why does it still matter to you, and how has it stood the test of time?
Well, I think it kind of comes back to what we were just talking about. The manner in which this seemingly simple film, I mean, it's a very simple, basic kind of idea. But I think that the way Spielberg, and of course, you have to give a lot of credit to Melissa Matheson, the screenwriter.
Absolutely.
As well, who sort of took Spielberg's ideas and shaped them and gave them form.
Mm-hmm.
The way in which they dramatize these very basic emotions, these very sort of pure, intense emotions, and put it in the package of this narrative of a little boy befriending an alien. You know, it's one of the things, it's kind of like the shark in Jaws. It's like, it could have gone badly in so many ways. Mm. That movie could have turned out terrible for so many reasons, but it didn't. And you can imagine the same kind of thing with E.T., that it could have spun into just maudlin sappiness, or it could have been cheesy, or it could have been unconvincing. Mm-hmm. But it's like at every dangerous curve, Spielberg just manages to pitch the moment just right,
right,
and just cut it just the right moment, or give us just the right response shot, or, you know, that it just works. And the fact that it continues to affect audiences so much, that audiences of so many different ages connect with it and understand it and feel it. You know, it's just, there are a lot of really good movies that you just don't feel on like a gut heart level.
Mm-hmm.
And this one you really do.
Yeah, no question about that. Yeah, I think E.T. the Extraterrestrial, it still packs a strong emotional punch 40 years after its release, Jim, likely because Spielberg focuses less on science fiction, fantasy, and special effects, and more on like real world enchantment,
mm-hmm.
you know, to convey a very personal narrative from a kid's perspective, and that any child, any one of us, regardless of our age, you know, can feel if we put ourselves in Elliot's position. Despite the old school special effects limitations of 1982 compared to today's dazzling CGI wizardry, I think the effects hold up pretty good. especially the animatronics involved in making that mm-hmm. alien look so realistic, move and express itself believably.
Oh, absolutely.
Gotta be honest, I'm not a fan of the 2002 special edition re-release in which Spielberg took a Lucas-like approach to snazzing up E.T. with new effects. Did you see that when that came out?
Yeah, and I think it's one of the biggest mistakes he ever made in his career. And you notice that he immediately backtracked.
That's right, yeah.
He realized that he should not have messed with it, that he did nothing to improve it, and that he only kind of took away from what he had already achieved,
right.
that it didn't need that stuff at all.
So at least he had the wisdom to realize he made a mistake, and it kind of has vanished into obscurity. But again, the CGI in that version makes the alien look plastic perfect. And I mm-hmm. prefer the rough around the edges, rubbery charm of the creature's appearance in the 1982 original. So I think these are some of the things, despite the limitations of that era, that make it timeless and universal. It also still matters, Jim, to me because of its music.
Oh, yes.
The secret weapon to me behind this film's effectiveness is the brilliant score by composer John Williams. So I looked it up. It ranks number 14 on the American Film Institute's list of 25 greatest film scores, and he's got two or three or four maybe in that list. But this is high up there. And the soundtrack, it really does a lot of the heavy emotional lifting at critical moments. You think of when Elliot brings the creature into his home, just that poignant music playing in the background, and the flight across the moon sequence, of course, the death and rebirth of E.T., and that poignant farewell. The music just hits all the beats, and the editing is timed perfectly with that music. It's one of the great collaborations, Spielberg and John Williams, and one of my all-time favorite scores.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The music is essential. And it does do a lot of the sort of the heavy lifting, mm-hmm. although I would also add to that by suggesting that one of the reasons the music works as well as it does is because Spielberg has set up the emotional resonance before we get to those moments mm-hmm. that, you know, there's a tendency, and I've read this a lot in criticism of Spielberg's work as a whole, but E.T. in particular, that, you know, things get, too emotional at the end, that he's sort of, you know, overemphasizing things and, you know, with the music and with the moments. But to me, I don't see that at all, because I feel like he earns that ending through a lot of hard work early on, hard dramatic work.
I agree.
Dealing with Elliot, dealing with Elliot's family, dealing mm-hmm. with his loneliness and his anger. You know, he's in a lot of ways an angry, frustrated little boy, you know, in the dinner sequence after he first sees E.T. and they're having dinner and, you know, nobody believes him. And they're, you know, say, well, maybe it was, you know, this or that. And he's getting so mad. I think that's all really important and sometimes sort of, ignored in favor of the bigger moments in the film. But to me, those big moments work because of that setup, because of the dramatic establishment mm-hmm. early on, where these are real people in a real house having real problems. And then, you know, like you said, I mean, they're special effects, but it's not about the special effects.
No.
It's about those relationships. It's about those connections.
Yeah, it's really about the three kids, Elliot, most importantly. It's told from their point of view. It's literally the camera is down at their height most of the shots. And if you put yourself back in that time frame when you were a child, it's an emotional time. You remember things and you respond to things much more emotionally, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
because you're a child and that's the way you process things. And you could be really sad or really happy or really scared or whatever. The emotions are just that much more impactful. So it makes sense to me that the music is going to be that much more impactful as well. Some people accuse him of being over-sentimental, maudlin, manipulative emotionally, etc. He has to be in this movie. This is an extremely personal narrative.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of his life. He's doing it through the prism of Elliot. But I totally believe it because it's coming from his heart. He's not trying to do anything artificially here to me. And we are so invested in the lives of these children. How can you not have a score like John Williams has composed? I mean, how else could you handle this kind of subject matter? It's going to make you cry if you have a heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. And a lot of people apply the same criticisms to other filmmakers like Frank Capra. It's a Wonderful Life. You think of that?
Right.
Come on. That's an unimpeachable classic, and so is E.T., and I'm never afraid to defend films like this because, it may not work for you. You may not like that kind of tone to a film. It may not be adult enough for you, but you were a kid once.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if you're watching this and kind of putting yourself in Elliot's shoes, it's going to be an emotional experience for you. And one more point here, just in terms of how it stood the test of time and so forth. Its legacy has not been diluted by inferior sequels.
Yes.
This happens so many times to film franchises that suffer lesser subsequent chapters following the first installment, right? At one time, Spielberg, he pondered the idea of helming a sequel, but thankfully he didn't. So E.T. is that rare blockbuster masterpiece that had no follow-ups or prequels for that matter. And I think that means its reputation hasn't been tarnished in any way.
Yeah, I think that definitely plays in its favor, to be sure, because, yeah, I mean, inferior sequels and prequels, they can't take away from the original literally, but they can certainly cloud the perspective,
sure.
You know, where they all get sort of mixed up in our understanding of them. And, you know, by this point in his career, you know, Spielberg had gotten very, very protective of his works. You know, he had had some bad experiences. First, when Universal lifted shots out of Duel to insert into an episode of The Incredible Hulk on television.
Right.
That he was just livid about, because he just couldn't understand how they could take his work and just chop it up and use it as filler shots for, you know, a TV show. Then when they made Jaws 2 without his involvement, and he recognized, you know, how quickly that kind of thing can happen. Mm-hmm. And so he became very protective of his films. And I think, yeah, he rightly saw that E.T. is, and again, I think this speaks to its timelessness and its, you know, its kind of perfection, is that it's just a fully encased work. Everything you need from the work is in the film.
Exactly.
You don't need more than he gives you. Mm-hmm. We don't really need to see what happens after that or what happened before it, that the emotional punch and the resonance of it is our filling in and our being left on that sort of slightly ambiguous ending at the end. It's like any great tragic romance in a way, you know, that somebody has to leave.
That's right.
You know, that it's not forever, and that it's not so important where does E.T. go or what happens to him after that, but just the idea that experience will somehow shape and change Elliot's life.
Right. Interestingly, we get a sequel of sorts in that commercial from a few years ago. Do you recall it?
Oh, yeah.
You have an adult Elliot who, I can't remember the scenario, but E.T. comes back and they kind of catch up and have some fun, and you know, it's a wink wink to the audience. It's not meant to be canon.
Right. It's a punch on the nostalgia button, you know, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm. So let's dig into, yeah, how was E.T. innovative or different, Jim, especially compared to previous sci-fi films about aliens, as well as earlier Spielberg pictures? So I'm trying to do a compare and contrast here, you know, leading up contextually to how E.T. was distinctive from earlier works.
Well, I mean, I think we tend to forget, because we're so inundated with science fiction now.
Mm-hmm.
We have so many science fiction movies and television shows and limited series, and, you know, aliens in our popular culture are just everywhere.
Yes.
But when Spielberg was working in this terrain in the late 70s and early 80s, nobody was doing this. Science fiction was not a popular genre. The studios were wary of it. When he made Close Encounters of the Third Kind, nobody had made a serious mainstream film about contact with aliens.
Well, maybe since 2001, right? A Space Odyssey.
Maybe since,
right?
Yeah, since 2001 is kind of like your one example. But even that doesn't involve aliens coming to Earth. You're still having to like go into the future and go out there.
Yeah.
So you have 2001, and then you have, you know, all of the, you know, Earth versus the Flying Saucers and The Thing from Another World and stuff like that in the 50s.
Right.
But it was all sort of dangerous, threatening aliens.
Maybe with the exception of It Came from Outer Space.
Yes.
Kind of features benevolent aliens.
Film.
But as far as benevolent aliens, you can count on one hand, even during the 1950s heyday of science fiction films. Maybe the day the Earth stood still, and that's even arguable if it's benevolent aliens, because you got Gort the killer robot, right? But
I was about to say, they're threatening to blow us up.
But for the vast majority, this subgenre was dominated by evil aliens, Martians, who were coming here to conquer or destroy.
Exactly. And there were very few of those kinds of films when you get into the late 70s and early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he's mining an element of the genre that is in a lot of ways more literary. Right. You know, if you look at science fiction literature, there are lots of stories about intelligent, benevolent aliens, human contact, you know, the fascination of, you know, not just they're here to destroy us, but how could we learn from them? How might there be, you know, some kind of relationship. And that was something, you know, Spielberg's dad was a big sci-fi enthusiast and he read those pulp magazines and stuff. And so I think that was kind of lodged in his head. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I mean, he was really kind of telling a different kind of story completely that we hadn't seen in a really long time and in only very limited ways. So he was taking the genre and working it toward more dramatic ends that, again, you know, yes, it's science fiction. There's an alien, there's a spaceship, mm-hmm. but it's really more about Elliot's emotional existence and how E.T. fits into that and how that affects him.
True. Yeah, it's so fascinating just to trace that kind of lineage of the earlier B pictures from the 50s to 1982 and here are the messages that strangers from different worlds can and should coexist in peace and find a way to communicate. Again, not a regular kind of drumbeat patterned message that you'd seen in previous works like this. And then I want to talk about, in terms of how it was different, you think about the creature design, mm-hmm. right? It was very, very distinctive compared to previous iterations of extraterrestrials on film. E.T., he kind of, you know, exhibits characteristics of several types of animals. He's got this long neck, wrinkly skin of a giant turtle, anthropomorphic kind of body of a long-armed ape, if you will. he's got these moist membranes like a frog or other amphibian might. The sound of a purring cat when he's content or he's sleepy. Of course, he has these oversized blue eyes that are wonderfully expressive. He waddles adorably like a penguin. Look closely at the fingers and the skin color and the texture. It kind of resembles the aliens from the 1953 War of the Worlds movie. Mm-hmm. I know those are bad guys, but yeah, especially the way he's introduced earlier, where you see his kind of arm and fingers outstretched to gather some foliage. It's very reminiscent of the introduction of the alien in War of the Worlds. But still, E.T. is a relatively unique or otherworldly organism that doesn't borrow necessarily from past pop culture extraterrestrials, like a classic Roswell-era alien. He's not that. He's not an alien necessarily that harkens to the Close Encounters of the Third Kind creatures, although Spielberg did say that the whole premise was, well, what if one of those Close Encounter aliens got left behind? So mm-hmm. I could imagine E.T. existing in that same world. But again, my point is you'd never seen a creature design quite like this.
No, it was really very, very unique. And like you said, it, you know, puts together a whole lot of familiar elements from different animals and, you know, things we're familiar with. But then when you put them all together, it becomes something totally unique and different. And,
yes.
You know, like you said, just incredibly expressive, you know, what Carlo Rambaldi was able to do with the animatronics and the puppetry and just the expressiveness of his face and his mm-hmm. eyebrows and his eyes and his mouth. It's just, you know, I mean, you really do get lost in the idea that this is not a special effect. This is a character.
Right. And it makes so much difference. Again, 40 years later, these are practical, real effects. It's not CGI. Those are several operators who are manipulating him like a puppet from afar. This is a real rubber mannequin type of figure that they're operating. In some scenes, there are, you know, small people in a suit kind of waddling around, but very minimal. So again, it feels real because these are real effects.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
That makes a big difference. Also, some believe that E.T. turned aliens into pop culture icons and gave a memorable face to an alien being that was safe for and acceptable to children. You think about they hadn't really merchandised or marketed an iconic kind of alien character before E.T. It wasn't devised to be undeniably cute and cuddly, per se, although a lot of the you know, merchandise that sprung from it certainly made it look cuddly. Mm-hmm. But again, the E.T., the creature in the movie itself, it has tactile and visual qualities that give it a strange, outlandish appearance. At the same time, its short stature, enormous peepers, its docile temperament make it non-threatening and endearing. So again, hats off. Kudos to, as you said, the designer Carlo Rambaldi and all the filmmakers and people behind the scenes who really brought this creature to life. But they weren't necessarily going for 100% cute and cuddly. This was meant to be a little bit off-putting in the design, and I think that really works.
Yeah, and I mean, and you have to remember, for the first 25, 30 minutes of the movie, E.T. is a kind of threatening presence, that's or at right. least a mysterious unknown presence who right. is a little, you know, I mean, you can show the first 15 minutes of E.T. to someone who's never seen it and they think you're watching a horror film. You know, even from the opening credits, uh-huh. which are very, you know, low key, you know, kind of low music. It doesn't start with big bombastic, you know, emotional music. It's setting up mystery. It's setting yes. up suspense. It's what is this? Is it safe? Is it not? I mean, I remember reading an interview with Spielberg where he was talking about watching the movie for the first time with his own kids and how like kind of afraid they were during the first 15 minutes of the movie because they didn't know what is this thing? Is it should I be scared of it? And everything he's doing in terms of camera placement and angles and light and shadow and all that. I mean, it's a gothic, you know, forest
yeah,
there in Northern California. You know, it's really setting all that up. So the fact that design could work in bits and pieces for that effect, but then become something totally different in the second half of the film, you know, again, really speaks to the brilliance of it.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. Just to kind of finish the thought on how E.T. was different from previous sci-fi films and alien depictions. You know, you really hadn't had the presence of mind where a filmmaker will choose to shoot many scenes from the vantage point and height of a child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's bringing the viewer to Elliot's level or E.T.'s level or Gertie's level. Except for Elliot's mother, all the adults in the film are shown from the chest down or they're silhouetted or they're shot from afar or they're facelessly obscured until the third act of the movie when the government officials finally infiltrate Elliot's house. And I think of like the Charlie Brown cartoons, right, where the grown-ups are these secondary, voiceless, amorphous characters on the periphery. And I think that's kind of what Spielberg is going for here, where the adults really aren't that important to these kids until, of course, they become very important.
Yeah.
And the mother isn't, he says it in interviews, like she's not cut from the same cloth. She's kind of a child herself. And of course, you've got to have the mother, you know, included in this family in terms of, you know, full body depiction. We see her. She's fully characterized. She becomes an important character. But every other adult, until toward the end, you don't even see their heads.
Right.
It's a really interesting approach. And then, you know, although we are shown snatches of the alien early on, we don't see him, as you were describing, in a complete detailed form until about the second act when he becomes a fixture inside the house.
Right.
You think about King Kong, Jaws, Close Encounters, Jurassic Park, many other major genre entertainments, Jim. The filmmakers, they follow the proven rule of not fully introducing the creature until later in the story. And what does that do? Well, it organically builds anticipation and excitement.
Absolutely. Yeah, it establishes the idea. And of course, all those movies you mentioned, King Kong, Jaws, etc., you're establishing a monster. You're establishing right. something threatening and you're building that threat. And that's what's sort of interesting and fascinating about the way E.T. is structured. That it's building the idea of a threat, which is, of course, such a childhood kind of thing, you know, where every shadow, every open closet door, every moving tree branch could be something, you know, terrifying, but then is exactly the opposite.
Yes, absolutely.
Not threatening at all. And that it's really in classic sort of progressive sci-fi style, it's us, it's the humans, it's the people who are threatening to it, not it to us.
True. Okay, let's explore briefly ways in which E.T. was influential on pop culture or cinema for that matter. So if I can kick things off, this was the feature that proved that family films could be commercially successful and popular again, right? Because Disney and other studios at this time had difficulty making inroads at the box office with family fare in the years prior to E.T. Hollywood was skittish in this era about putting serious money and resources into a movie designed to appeal to all ages. That's hard to even put your head around that today because, well, I know there's so many superhero movies, of course, and sci-fi, you know, summer blockbuster extravaganzas, but there are a lot of kids, you know, movies, a lot of Pixar and the knockoff kind of films. I mean, that's a huge revenue stream for Hollywood these days. But back 40 years ago, no, not so much. And this gamble really paid off handsomely because in 1983, looking it up, E.T. overtook Star Wars to claim the title of the highest grossing film ever. By the conclusion of its theatrical run, it had grossed, this is correct, $359 million in North America, $619 million worldwide. So it sold more than 120 million tickets in its initial theatrical run. That is astounding, like even for 1982. But adjusted for inflation, E.T. today, where do you think it ranks all time? Again, adjusted for inflationary dollars.
Oh, I'm sure it's up there, probably in the top 10 still.
Oh, it's number four, Jim. It's number four. It's right behind Gone with the Wind, Star Wars, and The Sound of Music. So
yeah.
I look at those lists because, again, it's so easy to top these lists with today's dollars. They charge more for tickets.
Yeah, so, $15.
But other ways it was influential. Well, it firmly established Steven Spielberg as the world's most popular and famous director, I think we can agree.
Mm-hmm.
He was a man at this point with the Midas touch. He had consecutively helmed Jaws, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He did a bomb with 1941, but nobody remembers it. And then he does Raiders of the Lost Ark, and then E.T., and he continues with the sequel to Indiana Jones. And then he takes a detour. But again, up to this point, it's like he could do no wrong. And he was, you know, king of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
It helped usher in the era of product placement into the movies, for better or worse.
Oh, yes.
You recall, of course, Reese's Pieces. Kind of I think that was a new product at that time, wasn't it?
I'm sure that executive at M&M's who turned it down still has nightmares about it.
But you have a lot of product placement, of course, Star Wars toys, but it's done organically. It makes sense. It's Elliot kind of showing him his room, but it is a little bit of a commercial for like Kenner Star Wars toys.
Yeah.
Coca-Cola is mentioned prominently. So for better or worse, yeah, you get the era of product placement helped by E.T., inspired inferior knockoffs. I don't know if you had the displeasure, Jim, of ever seeing Mac and Me.
I knew you were going to bring that up eventually. It was inevitable.
Don't even waste your brain cells, but look it up as a bit of a trivial curiosity. It is just an unashamed, pure ripoff of a movie. But hey, E.T. also influenced later quality works like Starman, Gremlins, The Goonies, Flight of the Navigator, The Iron Giant, AI, Artificial Intelligence. Lilo and Stitch is a bit of an homage in a way to E.T. Super 8, Earth to Echo. So there's numerous examples of quality movies that, of course, took inspiration from E.T. And then just as a bit of trivia, let's not forget this. I know you were young. I was 13 at this time. But Neil Diamond had a huge hit in late 82 with the song Heartlight.
Heartlight, yeah.
Yeah, it rose to number 5 on the Billboard chart. So it just speaks to how E.T. had pervaded popular culture. Real quickly, we can credit E.T. with catapulting the careers of Drew Barrymore and Peter Coyote. I know they weren't all-time box office stars, but they had long, successful careers.
Yeah, and I think that's the kind of movie it is as far as the casting goes, which I think is worth mentioning, which is that Spielberg wasn't casting movie stars, which is the same way he cast Jaws.
Right.
You know, the studio wanted big stars, and he wanted Roy Scheider and Richard Dreyfuss, and, you know, character actors, people who looked and sounded like actual people.
Right.
And I think that's one of the reasons E.T. works so well, you know, is that Dee Wallace looks and feels and acts like a struggling single mom trying to hold it together. She's not glamorous. She's not, you know, she's very attractive, but she's also just very normal. And you can just see her struggling to hold a family together and, you know, make it like, okay, yeah, you're going to have to stay at home. I've got to go to work. I can't stay home with you. You're going to be okay. Getting duped with the old, you know, light bulb on the thermometer.
I wish I would have known that trick.
I know. I was too goody-goody to do that. But yeah. And so, you know, and Peter Coyote, I mean, he looks like a guy that you could imagine being a scientist.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
when
he's finally revealed, he's not some spectacular looking movie star. He's just a guy who is like what Elliot will be when he grows up.
Yeah. And then one more final point. I mean, this is an intimate, engaging movie that Spielberg considered his most personal film. He said in an interview that E.T. was about the divorce of my parents, how I felt after my parents broke up. It was the first movie I ever made for myself. And then think about how huge of a commercial and critical success that E.T. was in 82, 83. It gave Spielberg the confidence to craft more personal films in the years to come. He established himself as the definitive action adventure and sci-fi filmmaker between, you know, Jaws and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. But starting in 1985 with like The Color Purple, continuing through Empire of the Sun and of course Schindler's List, Saving Private Ryan and beyond, we see new facets of his talents and different genres explored beyond the summer blockbuster fare.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that if, you know, if E.T. is truly exemplary of something, mm-hmm. I think it is exemplary of Spielberg's ability to make a very personal film that's also a blockbuster. Mm. That's incredibly hard to do and incredibly rare. And I think it's one of the reasons that we're still talking about mm-hmm. it 40 years later, and we'll be talking about it on its 80th anniversary.
Yeah, by comparison, you think about Alfred Hitchcock, and I think he confessed in interviews that Vertigo was his most personal movie. Mm-hmm. And certainly if you analyze it, that bears fruit. But it wasn't a commercial success. So even a filmmaker as talented as Hitchcock and a masterpiece as exemplary as Vertigo, it may not become a commercial success. And this one did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of at the wrong time. But E.T., I think, was sort of at the right time. Mm-hmm. And that whole personal angle of him basically making a film about his own childhood pain and right. loneliness and struggle and putting those emotions into this, and again, this kind of sort of a formula in a way. You know, he describes like boy meets alien, alien saves boy, boy saves alien, you know, kind of thing. But the emotions are real. In a lot of ways, they're very raw. Mm. And I think that's something that we kind of take for granted and sometimes doesn't get talked about, you know, a whole lot with the film, is that it works so well because those emotions do cut and run so deep. Because they were Spielberg's emotions and he knows them and he feels them and he really put them in there. And I remember reading an interview where, you know, Alice Walker, the author of The Color Purple, she agreed to have her book adapted. You know, she had say over who the director was. And so here comes, you know, Steven Spielberg, this white Jewish filmmaker associated with genre films. Why should he be directing this film about the experiences of, you know, a black woman in Jim Crow America? Mm. And she basically turned to E.T. and she's like, he knows these feelings. He knows these emotions. He yeah. knows what it feels like to be on the outside and to be isolated and misunderstood.
Wow, what high
if
praise.
He can do that through an alien, I think he can do this. And he did.
Fascinating. Yeah. Let's pivot here and talk briefly about themes, messages, morals explored in E.T. So what do you see, Jim? What stands out to you as a message?
I think the thing that really comes through in the film is the importance of connection. Mm-hmm. And even though it's, you know, between a boy and an alien, I think we can sort of look beyond the literalness of it and see it as a relationship and how crucial relationships are and being and feeling understood and understanding others. I mean, it's a very empathetic film because we're being asked to understand these characters who are struggling, who are going through a difficult time, through divorce, through loneliness, through frustration. And then, of course, you know, E.T. being literally orphaned, isolated, left behind, terrified, and the importance of making those connections and feeling those connections. And I think that's really, you know, people talk about the end of the film is everything is wrapped up neatly. No, it's not. It's not wrapped up neatly at all. When E.T. leaves, Elliot is still going to be a lonely little boy from a divorced family whose dad is in Mexico with Sally. Mm. But he's had this experience and he's seen a better way. And he knows something that he didn't know before and that maybe he can. And to me, that's the film leaves you with sort of not something wrapped up neat in a bow, but rather just a sense of hope that he will go on, that he will transcend this moment in his life and become a better person on the other side.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, there's so many themes we can kind of plumb here, but I'm going to summarize a few of them and see what you feel about them. Of course, one to me is the value of maintaining a sense of wonder and imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Because this picture makes you feel young again. It taps into the mysteries and energy of childhood. You know, how magical it is to find something genuinely precious that is your unique secret, trying to find your place in a world where you don't fit in and being in awe of the marvels and mysteries of the universe. I think, Jim, that it speaks to the power that children have to possess a powerful sense of imagination, preserve awe and reverence for magic, be resourceful and resilient, remain open and receptive to the idea that, yeah, you know, aliens, monsters, or the supernatural, maybe they can exist and we can communicate and connect with life and nature in a way that most adults have forgotten or can't. And I think it's important that the movie references Peter Pan and often plays on that tale's themes because, you know, you recall Peter Pan, you can fly, you can have adventures, you can wish upon a star for a miracle, you can defeat the pirates, or maybe in this case, the adults trying to take E.T. away. Remember that the Keys adult character is like a grown-up Elliot or like a former Peter Pan. He's been wishing for this since he was 10 years old, he says. So he wants to be a kid again, too. And then, of course, E.T. speaks to the importance of tolerance, compassion, understanding.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Christ-like rebirth at the heart of this story, too. I'm not a religious person, but I could clearly see the spiritual kind of undertones here. This is an uplifting story about a vulnerable creature who can work feats of magic, yet he gets sick, he dies, and then he's resurrected, right? Mm-hmm. So as in the New Testament, this reborn figure must leave this world and his apostles behind. And you have a true believer in Eliot who says at the end, "I'll believe in you all my life every day." Again, it's not my sauce, but I could see how it would speak to people who are looking for spiritual guidance or messages there.
Oh, absolutely. And even for those who are not religious, I mean, religious themes and that symbolism is something that cuts across, you know, human history and literature and art.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it definitely pulls from those strains. Absolutely.
Right. And then you've got disconnection from home and family is not healthy. I think that's a major theme here because E.T., he needs to return to his own kind in his own world.
Mm-hmm.
And he's rejuvenated because he's reconnected with his native loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
This suggests to me that Eliot as well must find a connection and treasure his life, hopefully with his own, you know, family in suburbia, even if he doesn't always fit in so well and he lacks a father.
Yeah.
It also underscores how E.T. and Eliot are connected and similar. You think about how E and T are the first and last letters of Eliot's name. So it kind of, there's a simpatico there. And then one more theme I kind of ruminated on when I rewatched this movie is the obvious one of feeling trapped, feeling imprisoned. Spielberg, he cleverly frames E.T. and the children behind windows and door blinds, grates, there's screens, there's lattices. And why? You ask, why would he do this? Well, likely for two reasons. Let's see what you think. But maybe one of the reasons is to suggest that there is only a thin veneer separating this alien creature from humankind. And to me, that implies that we share more similarities than you think. Secondly, maybe it's to symbolically convey that Eliot's home, while it can be a refuge, it can also be a prison keeping E.T. from his true home beyond the stars. So maybe I'm reaching here, but I think where there's smoke, there's fire. I think that he's going with something with some of these visual metaphors with blinds and screens and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it contributes to, you know, an overall sense of, like you said, in entrapment and being, mm-hmm. you know, caught in just in the situation that they're in, you know, Eliot's family situation.
Yes.
And E.T. being deserted home and not being able to get home.
Mm-hmm.
And you notice then how much the film opens up in the third act, you know, when it's bicycle, you know, kids riding bikes through open streets and
right.
jumping over hills and cars, finding a big open park, you know, where they go and then they're flying through the sky. It's almost like they break out of all of that entrapment
right.
at the end. And I think it may not be a sort of a literal thing, but it certainly works emotionally, you know, those visuals complementing the emotional registers makes it that much more powerful.
Yeah, totally agree. This is a 40th birthday celebration. Jim, it's customary to give presents on birthdays, right?
Absolutely.
Except it's the fans who continue to get the gifts. So what is E.T.'s greatest gift to viewers? What would you say?
I think it's just, it's that experience that it leaves you with, like you said. I mean, you walk out of the theater and you have seen something, you've experienced something,
mm-hmm.
you have made a connection through the screen. And as much as lots of movies I love, that doesn't always happen. And leaving you with that, I think, is really its greatest gift.
Yeah, no, short and to the point and well said, I agree. I think its greatest gift is that it remains one of the best family films ever. Again, you think about what does that mean, a family film? Today, it usually means a CGI fest, which can be, you know, great entertainment, well-written, you know, well-animated and so forth, and that's great. We're just bombarded by this kind of stuff, though. And when you think about a live-action family film, there aren't that many to point to that have really, really stood the test of time. You can't argue against something like The Wizard of Oz. That's going to be an all-time great family film.
Mm-hmm.
But E.T. should be right there as well in my book. And I think that's in no small part thanks to this decision to frame the narrative from the children's point of view, often place the camera at their height. I think that E.T. strikes a chord kind of with our inner child, the one who experienced things like loneliness or awkwardness, misunderstanding or alienation when we were young. And it's especially relevant to offspring of broken homes and divorce, to middle children, kids who grew up in the suburbs. It ticks all the boxes for Eliot, which is why he's a great composite character there. But it also, Jim, E.T. requires you also to be an actively engaged viewer because it involves your feelings. It moves you. Films that can evoke a strong emotional reaction in audiences are potent pictures that tend to be remembered and revisited. So trace back with me. For kids in the 30s and 40s, I wasn't alive, but history will bear out that a movie like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs or Dumbo or Bambi kind of claimed that mantle. Right. Mm-hmm. And there is genuine fright in those movies. There's genuine grief and loss. Major characters die. In the 1950s, it was Old Yeller. If you talk to people of that generation, that was a real weeper. Right. But it was also a family film. In the 60s, maybe 101 Dalmatians served that role. In the 70s, I recall this as a very young child, but it was a movie called Benji.
Oh, yes.
Where, again, you've got a very small creature and a dog that, you know, you're crying tears over because some great things and some bad things happened to that animal. In the 1980s, I think E.T. continues that tradition. Also, I just want to add this. You consider that the scenes depicting E.T.'s fading health and his death, they're collectively protracted. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember first time in the theater, like, it was really sad, man. This was going on for a long time. And it's not like I was looking at my watch and thinking, when is this going to end? But it was like, it was almost interminable. Oh, this is, I don't know how much more of this I can take, kind of a feeling when I was younger. And even as an adult, it is, I think about how long those scenes go on. It is long, but I think necessarily long, and for a good reason. Spielberg brings audiences to the depths of sadness and loss. And then he quickly elevates you to the heights of hope and exaltation, and it causes this kind of unforgettable emotional pendulum swing, right? So for younger viewers, this may be one of their first exposures to the death of a major character in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But you have those in Disney movies too, of course. Those are predecessors. But it's a death that leaves a lasting psychic imprint. And families who want to impart spiritual messages to their children are heartened by the rebirth of the alien, which, you know, suggests the possibility of an afterlife. Likewise, you think of E.T.'s message of "I'll be right here," which can comfort viewers, young and old, that our loved ones never really leave us so long as we remember and cherish them. So these are among the elements that make it timeless to me, and I think to a lot of other people. To me, those are the greatest gifts.
Yeah, absolutely.
So is there anything else you're working on right now, Jim, that listeners should know about? Anything in the works?
Well, I've got a book chapter coming out in an anthology on Jurassic Park.
Wow.
That'll be coming out in 2023 for its 30th anniversary, since, you know, it's a chapter on representations of science and scientists in both Jurassic Park, but in Spielberg's larger body of work as well. And then something very, very different. I'm currently writing a book for the British Film Institute classic film series on Midnight Cowboy.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
That's what I'm currently engaged with.
Fantastic. So you've got a lot going on there. And I'm curious, is that Jurassic Park book going to encompass the entire franchise, all of the sequels too?
It's going to discuss them to some degree, but it's focused primarily on Spielberg's film, the original.
Yeah, the first one. Well, yeah. He also did the first sequel.
He did do The Lost World. That's true. Yeah.
But you're going to really focus on the first one, right? Which I think is the best one.
Oh, absolutely.
Usually it's the first one in the series that takes the lead, if you will. So, well, that sounds very exciting. Anything else?
That's the main thing. And just, I'm still regularly reviewing for Q Network and just trying to keep up with everything that's being thrown at me.
That sounds very exciting, Jim. I wish you the best, especially with the coming academic year. I wish I was a student in your class because you're going to be bringing back Spielberg next year, right?
Yep. Always look forward to that class. It's a really fun one.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you again for taking the time to appear on Cineversary, coming back to our show. It's always a pleasure talking to you, sir. And you are the resident Spielberg expert who I'd like to consult in the future if an opportunity arises and you're available.
Well, I really appreciate that. I've had a great, great time talking E.T. with you, and I look forward to future conversations.
Fantastic. Have a wonderful summer.
Thank you. You too.
The next best thing to being a student in Mr. Kendrick's popular Spielberg class is to get a one-on-one sit-down with him on Cineversary, right? So great to get a return visit from him and talk about one of our shared personal faves. Thanks again, Jim. All right, next up to bat is Cassin Gaines. Now, heads up that his new book on the making of E.T. will not be released until August, so he was kind of limited by the publisher and what he was allowed to say about the book contents, but he still gives us a pretty good flavor of what we can expect from the book and what he learned in writing it. It's my pleasure to welcome Cassin Gaines to Cineversary. Cassin is an author, director, educator, and popular culture historian. And he's recently written a book about E.T. called E.T. the Extraterrestrial, The Ultimate Visual History. Now, this is due to be released this August. welcome to our podcast, Cassine, and thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, such a pleasure. So what prompted you to write this book? Where did this come from? Like, was this something in the works for a long time?
You know, that's such a funny question because it really was in the works for quite some time. You know, it's the 40th anniversary of E.T. right now.
Mm-hmm.
But the book wasn't originally intended for the 40th anniversary. You know, I'm of the belief that there's always a good time to celebrate good cinema. You don't necessarily need an anniversary.
Right.
And Inside Editions, which is the publisher for this book, they just do these beautiful coffee table books, these ultimate visual histories and just visual. If you've never seen an Inside Editions book, you're missing out. I mean, they're just these beautiful works of art. They wanted to do an E.T. book. They were going to partner with Amblin on an E.T. book. And I first heard about this book, I want to say it was in 2017, which,
oh, wow,
I know sounds crazy, but I believe it was that long ago. I have to say it's funny because in thinking about, you know, like, why did I want to tell this story, you know, write the story about the making of E.T.? It's just such a seminal film. It's a film that I think almost more than, like, much like The Wizard of Oz, right? Like, it's a film that it doesn't matter what country you're watching it in, where you were born, your race, your class, your gender. It's like everyone can connect with this film because there's something so innately human about this story of an extraterrestrial coming to Earth and finding love and comfort and being afraid and being alone, but also finding community and wanting to go back home. It's just an amazing story. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's Steven Spielberg, it's Amblin, it's E.T. I would just love to be a part of this,
sure,
like in any way. Like, I'll write the captions, just like, I just wanna be a part of this. And I was so, so, so glad that I was able to be the person to write this.
You gave me a little sneak preview, just of some of the photographs, for example, and probably about 90% of the photos, you know, I quickly glanced at, I'd never seen before. So yeah, walk us through, you know, why it's called a visual history and what was your overall approach to this, let's say different from any other type of making of.
I am a firm believer in, I just love behind the scenes stories of film, you know?
Right.
The way that I sort of think about the ultimate visual history is it's really both things. It's a history in terms of its text. I interviewed so many people for this book, you know, gosh, almost all of the actors, special effects people, pretty much everyone that you would ask me, did you speak to them? The answer is pretty much yes. The way that we sort of approach this is, we want to take you on the full journey, like as if you were doing an archaeological dig through Amblin's archives, because frankly, that's really what this book is. We went through and you're going to see, you know, there's like handwritten notes,
okay,
on storyboards, on pages of scripts being revised. There's comps, artwork comps, poster art,
yeah,
that like never materialized, never before been seen. Some of it just in sketch form.
Okay.
You're going to see Polaroids that were taken on set. And that's really rare for E.T., especially because, as you likely know, it was a very closed set. So, I mean, anyone who was able to take a camera onto the set was authorized to take a camera because they were, you know, a high up person in the production,
right,
that was doing,
right,
something important that warranted them having a Polaroid. So there are pictures in here that are not just from Amblin's archives, but they are from crew members' personal collections.
Mm-hmm.
They are from the actors' personal collections. You know, people were so incredibly generous with the ephemera that they allowed us to borrow for,
yeah,
this book, because we really want it to be something special. I think when you say, well, there's going to be a new book out on E.T. and there's going to be a lot of pictures and a lot of stories, people sometimes sort of say, well, it's been 40 years. I've watched the DVD special features. I've watched the Blu-ray. I've read up on it. You know, I'm sure there, you know, everything there is to know about this film,
mm-hmm,
is already out there. And I'm telling you, if you are a fan of E.T., you're about to be blown away, not just the visuals, but the stories, you know, hindsight, you know, it's been 40 years. So everyone that I've spoken to, they've been able to sort of look in the rear view mm-hmm. and comment on the ET phenomenon from that perspective. So it's a wild ride. It's a really great ride.
Sounds like something we could really anticipate, look forward to here. And I understand contractually you can't spill the beans on everything here. Is there anything you could tease us on that maybe someone might learn that they didn't know before about E.T.?
Sure. For example, the person who made E.T.'s eyes. I mean, like when you think about like how, you know, sort of simplistic that is, mm-hmm. but when you look at E.T., the first thing that you see are these big, beautiful eyes sure. that draw you in. Mm-hmm. And it was actually a lot of work to get those right. It was a lot of work to scale them appropriately, how they were built, what the sort of function was in terms of story. So the relationship between Carlo Rambaldi as the puppet maker, but also the person who was making the eyes, who was a separate person, like they had to have some level of collaboration as well. Mm-hmm. That person was chosen by Kathy Kennedy and Steven Spielberg. So they had, so just that one aspect,
right?
You're going to be able to hear from people who, when I called them up, said that they had never in 40 years ever given an interview about E.T. I mean, just think about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you're really giving an idea of the deep dive that you take and something that you may take for granted, like E.T.'s eyes. The design and execution of those eyes is crucial to selling that alien, to really making us empathize with it and put ourselves in Elliot's shoes and so forth. Mm-hmm. Of course, you're going to tell the big picture, but you're also going to drill down into some smaller, sometimes overlooked facets, right?
Yeah. I mean, even down to... I spoke with some of the like stunt performers, mm-hmm. You know, people that were that worked in marketing okay. on the Universal end. So not even people that were directly affiliated with the film. Obviously, we had to get into things like the video game, the Atari game.
Oh, yeah. So, I remember that.
You know, so I feel pretty confident that pretty much everything that's covered
yeah.
from before E.T. was conceived of all the way through. It's a really full history and I'm excited for people to, I can't wait for people to see it.
So what did you learn just, you know, in this process of the interviews, writing the book that lends a new appreciation to the film itself? So are you looking at E.T. through a different lens now? Have you revisited the movie and now it's like, you're really paying attention to this?
Yeah, I think the number one thing that I learned and appreciate that I learned about the filmmaking process is how on the fly so much of it was. Mm-hmm. You know, E.T., from the very first time I saw it, it always felt like a fully realized film that had been kind of perfectly calibrated and the story was tight and all the performances were great.
Yeah.
And what I was sort of amazed by was Spielberg had storyboards that were being made for the film. And at some point he said, you know, I'm not even using these. You know, I want to be able to go on the set. I have the script. I want to be able to just go on the day and be inspired by the kids mm-hmm. and by the actors and what they bring. And he would workshop with them, not just him, but also Kathy Kennedy and Melissa Matheson, the screenwriter. They would sort of work with the kids. And sometimes the kids would come up with different ways or, you know, better ways to say the lines.
Some level of improvisation was allowed.
It definitely. And it was welcomed. And, you know, they were so, they being Stephen, Kathy, and Melissa, they were so aware that this film would not work if the kids did not feel like kids, if they were not real kids in the 80s. And so, even when she was writing the screenplay, Melissa at the time was dating Harrison Ford and Harrison had kids of his own. And so she was, you know, certainly, you know, she was essentially almost like family to them at the time. And so she interviewed them and interviewed their friends and found out what their slang was and what they liked to do. And so much of like the bike riding and the Dungeons and Dragons and, you know, the fashion really was informed by kids in the 80s because she had sort of an eye and an ear to them. And so I think realizing how much of the film was, because they had a small budget, they had to come up with creative ways to do it. Because they had very limited time for reasons that I go into in the book, they had to come up with creative ways to do things. And because they were working with a script that was really solid at the beginning, they didn't have to make a lot of changes between the first draft and what you see on the screen, but they had a great framework, I guess I'll say, to work within. Mm. And then they just let those kids and those actors kind of play within the framework. In fact, Peter Coyote gave me a really great story of a moment where something on the page just wasn't really working for him. Mm-hmm. And he went to Steven and said, you know, do you mind if I rewrite this half a page? And, you know, Steven said, well, you know, why don't you go home and write something up and, you know, I'll take a look at it the next day. And the next day, Steven looked at it, Melissa looked at it. They made a couple of tweaks from what Peter had written. And then they shot it the way Peter wrote it. Mm. So, I mean, it was truly a collaborative experience. Right. And I think, you know, saying it's a collaborative experience is sort of a cliche, but it seems like it was really like all of the people that worked on this film had an opportunity to sort of put their thumbprint on what you see on the screen beyond what their job description was.
Well, it speaks to, you know, Spielberg's benevolence, his compassion, and his generosity, because you hear these kinds of stories in a lot of his productions in which, you know, he's willing to keep an open ear to ideas and suggestions and so forth. And I think that would have been instrumental, so crucial on a movie like E.T.
And it's a lack of ego,
too. Exactly.
You know, it's a trust for the team that you've assembled. And I, like you said, I think, you know, respect is the key word there. I think you hit the nail on the head there.
Absolutely. So I want to ask you if you could briefly recall when you first saw E.T. I don't know if you were too young at the time of its original release, but what does it mean to you personally? How important is this movie to you?
So E.T. is really important to me. I remember actually distinctly having, the first time I saw it was on VHS.
Okay.
I'm a little too young to have seen it in the theater. I remember, and I don't know if you remember this, it was the VHS had like a little green, you know, the button that you press that like brings down the flap so you can see the tape inside. It was like green. So like, there was like a green side to the black VHS. And I remember even before the film was in, like looking at the box and being like, what's going on here? Like they're flying over the moon. And then like looking at the tape and being like, even the tape is special. You know, the VHS tape was unique. And I remember honestly, as much as I want to say I was captivated, I was really afraid at the beginning of E.T. Like I just, my first feeling of E.T. was that opening sequence, mm-hmm. being terrified, not knowing, you know, who the bad guys were, you know, like what was going on, like all of those sounds in the forest, like you just see the shadows and the heart light. And like, I just remember being like, what is going on? Like, and I knew it wasn't a scary movie because my grandfather was very, very, you know, hip to what was going on. And he used to tape video, you know, tape movies from HBO all the time. And he was kind of like an old man video pirate, you know, back in the day. But I knew that he had seen it and wouldn't have given me like a scary movie. I was really, really young, but I was really kind of afraid. And also, much like Elliot in the film, I slowly was kind of drawn in and I warmed up. And by the end, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe he's leaving. No, this is horrible. And I'm like, wait a second. It was like an hour and a half ago. I was terrified of this thing. And so I just think that speaks so much to the beautiful structure of the film and what Steven Spielberg was able to accomplish through this narrative. And actually also the brilliance of Carlo Rambaldi and the creature design, because I mean, he's cute in a way, I guess, you know, but E.T. could have been a little bit cuter, you know, not so wrinkly, not so squishy, not so moist.
They could have applied the Ewok effect.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. They could have gone the Ewok route, but instead E.T. has to win you over, and E.T. does. But I think that's a better reward, isn't it, than just having this like cutesy teddy bear.
Well, he's almost like an exotic foreign animal, you know, like let's say an amphibian or some kind of a reptile or something that you may have never seen before. And you realize that he's delicate, but he's also not exactly cute and cuddly. He pulsates. He has oily skin. He has wrinkles. Mm. He looks weird. So I think that from a kid's perspective, which of course this tale is told, It's almost like they've discovered this last species of its kind, never before seen on Earth, and they have to protect it, and they fall in love with it. But it's also a little bit odd. It's easy to do this now as an adult. As a kid, you're just drawn into the story. You're not thinking about these things. But I think it really is a very smart design.
Well, and I think also there's sort of a brilliance in what Steven Spielberg does here, where... and he's spoken about this before, but like, you know, his father always sort of instilled in him this appreciation for outer space. And, you know, whether it's Close Encounters, Steven always had the philosophy that if creatures were going to travel however many light years to come visit Earth, would they go all that way just to do us harm? Like, for what? Like, what do we have here that would cause, you know, we're not threatening them, you know, like, so what would they come here and unprovoked come to start trouble? And I think that there were so many films and television shows that sort of viewed creatures or visitors from outer space as this sort of hostile place.
Right.
But one of the things that Steven Spielberg does so wonderfully is he uses the stars as a backdrop to spark wonder and curiosity and not fear.
What a novel idea here. You have an extraterrestrial who visits Earth with his fellow aliens, and they're botanists, they're horticulturalists, they're scientists, right? And they're just collecting different species of plants and, you know, to study, to maybe to grow them on their own planet. They don't mean us any harm. But again, they're not just here to like probe human beings or something. They're here to collect plants. It's a very unique, refreshing kind of way to introduce an alien character.
Part of that is society, right? Like, you know, if you think about like the 50s and 60s, you know, there was sort of fear of nuclear war, you know, like, you know, there were different fears that, you know, people were going to come to America and invade and come to bring us home.
You got mutant aliens back then. You got the ugly aliens.
Yeah.
You have the destructive, violent aliens, and they were often like horror movie creatures.
Right. It's funny to me too, that E.T. to me feels so much like the quintessential Spielberg film, but at the time of E.T.'s release, it was really kind of an outlier. I mean, isn't that so funny that like now we think about, you know, we think about this as being like on brand Spielberg, but obviously, you know, this wasn't Jaws. This wasn't even Close Encounters.
No,
you know?
But I mean, this proved to be his most commercially successful and arguably possibly critically successful film.
Yeah. Which is and well deserved, especially for a film that, you know, he felt was his small little film.
Right.
You know, it wasn't a big shoot. It wasn't a large cast. I mean, the cast is tiny. You know, like it's a really intimate film. And you know, it's funny. You asked me about the first time I watched E.T. The thing that also stands out to me from the first viewing, and I remember this distinctly, was the kitchen scene. You know, in the opening when the boys are ordering the pizza and they're playing Dungeons and Dragons, because to me that just felt like I was watching someone's home movie.
Exactly. As he demonstrated in Close Encounters and again in Poltergeist, and you know, maybe a few other movies, but especially those three, he really nails suburban life so well.
Yeah.
And like the dynamics of a relatively dysfunctional family and these, you know, surrounding peripheral friends and all of that, and all of the accoutrements and the baggage and, you know, the merchandise, the pop culture relics of that time and so forth, down to the perfect television commercial, the perfect snippets on TV, you know, the products throughout. He knows how to tell that story with realistic details.
And it comes from just being willing to be honest. This was, in a broad sense, obviously, you know, kind of, I'm tempted to use the word, you know, semi-autobiographical, but emotionally autobiographical, obviously, you know, for Steven Spielberg. And this was a story that he wanted to tell for a long time. He didn't know exactly how he wanted to tell it, but from that emotional position, he'd been living with this story for a while. And I think that you just see that honesty come across in this story. You know, it's funny because you can see when he talks about this film today, he still, I think in some ways, is surprised that it resonated with so many other people. Because more than Jaws, more than Close Encounters, he was really making this for himself.
That's right. Cassine, this was a real pleasure. I appreciate your time. Thanks again for appearing on Cineversary.
Thank you so much.
My gratitude to Cassine for spending some time with us here on Cineversary, and we wish him the best of luck with his new book. It's time now for Standing Ovations. This is where I give a shout out to a website, television program, film, book, podcast, or other work that I think would be of interest to classic film lovers just like you. For June, my endorsement goes to a fantastic podcast called The Secret History of Hollywood. I've actually shouted out about this one, many moons ago, but it's time again to sing its praises. Now, this is written, narrated, and produced by Adam Roche, and his latest series is called Cary, which explores the life and career of actor Cary Grant over several episodes. To date, three parts in the series are now available, with more to come. In part one of Cary, you'll hear the incredible journey of Archibald Leach, one that stretched from broken beginnings all the way to the heavens of Hollywood itself. In part two, after discovering that the mother he thought was dead is actually alive, Cary Grant must reconcile his own guilt, the effects of the revelation upon his own relationships, and the fact that his star in Hollywood seems to be fading. And in part three, after a devastating personal tragedy, Cary has begun to focus upon his career as an escape, still in search of the elusive hit that will prove his worth to the world. Adam Roche has a lot of credit in my book for his stellar past explorations of Val Lewton, Alfred Hitchcock, Universal Horror Films, Warner Brothers Studios, and several other outstanding Secret History of Hollywood series that I'm a big fan of. If you're a fan of classic films and the golden age of Tinseltown, hey, take the time to subscribe to The Secret History of Hollywood and its newest series, Cary, available on all major podcast platforms. Like what you hear on Cineversary? We'd love to get your feedback. Whether you want to nominate a movie for a future anniversary episode, provide comments, or just have a question, get a hold of us at cineversegroup@gmail.com. That's cineverse group@gmail.com. Also, you can really help our show grow by spreading the good word about the Cineversary podcast to your friends and loved ones. Even better, please leave a positive online review and rating, which significantly helps us get discovered by new listeners. So if you use Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or CastBox, simply search for the Cineversary page, look for a link that says something like ratings or reviews, click that, and leave that rating or review. While you're at it, take a moment to like us on Facebook, too. And if you'd like to go an extra step and help keep our show ad-free, consider making a donation to the Cineversary podcast by visiting tinyurl.com/donatecineversary. We really appreciate your support. Lastly, we encourage you to visit cineversegroup.com. That's the portal for my private film discussion group I launched back in 2005, where you can hear recordings of our group discussions and read in-depth analyses about the different movies we study. St. Patrick's Day is now far behind us, but the luck of the Irish remains with us whenever we revisit one of the most beloved works of John Ford. In July, we will spotlight his ode to Ireland, The Quiet Man, originally released in the summer of 1952, 70 years ago. Until next time, this is your humble host, Eric Martin, reminding you to butter up that popcorn, live a big screen surround sound life, and cherish those classic movies, because as I always say, they're not getting older, they are getting better. Thanks, as always, for giving us a listen.